Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and that was Money, the Barrett Strong cover. It was a standard at the Lakeside Lounge Jukebox in the East Village in New York, and joining us on the phone is one of the co-proprietors of the late, great Lakeside Lounge, our friend Eric Amble. How you doing, Eric?
Very good, Dave. Thanks for it's great to be talking to you.
And Money is from the upcoming record, Lakeside. Tell us about the record. When's it available?
It's available from my website, ericamble.com, and it's kind of a crazy thing. It's available vinyl only, and there are only 500 copies. They're all signed and numbered, but they come with a digital download, two different ones, one CD quality and one of that 192 high-res audio quality.
And why did you take that approach?
Well, I mean, I really value music, and I made this thing and worked really hard on it. You know, I hired a producer, Jimbo Mathis. I wanted to do a beautiful vinyl package. You know, even I had to wait for the record. You know, I don't know if your listeners know how long it takes to get vinyl, but vinyl, it's a 6 to 8 month wait between the approving the artwork and test pressings and getting the records pressed. You know, that every vinyl press in the whole world that is operational is running 24/7 to make vinyl right now. But it really felt worth it when I just intercepted the records last week so I could sign and number them, and holding the thing in my hand, it really felt the way it was supposed to for something that's really special. You know, to me, it's like a homemade card beats Hallmark every time. And I just wanted to do something really great for the people that might like it.
Now, the reason that it is, I'm holding it in my hand. It's a very warm project. It's an homage to your roots here in the Chicago area. I mean, you've played with Steve Earle, you've played with Joan Jett, played with our friend Dan Baird. But tell us about growing up here in Lakeside. I mean, the cover of the record is from Lake Geneva, right?
Yeah, there's a my family got a summer home in Fontana, Wisconsin, which is on the west end of Lake Geneva. It was 1969. That's the summer that man landed on the moon. And ever since then, we'd move up there for our whole summer, and we'd go up there on the weekends in the winter to go skiing. And, you know, my family, I grew up in Batavia, but my family doesn't have a house anymore, but we still have the lake house. And my sort of personal cliche as a traveling musician is that I've been everywhere twice, and the lake is probably the only place I really miss.
Uh-huh.
And the cover, Gordy's is the marina there in Fontana. And actually, Gordy, his family, they own almost everything in Fontana. And so they have a bar called Chuck's. They couldn't have Gordy's on every sign. But that was, you know, where I went as a kid. And Gordy's has a webcam. And when my dad got pancreatic cancer, I learned about the webcam. And I used to check the webcam before I called my dad, you know, to see what kind of day it was. And, you know, because I was calling him all the time, and I'd just have a look at the webcam, see what it looked like there up at the lake before I called my dad. And I got in a routine of, you know, it's pretty much part of my coffee thing is to click on the Gordy's webcam and see what the lake looks like. And I have folders full of screen grabs and a whole thing on Facebook of the Gordy's webcam. And my friend Chris Bryson, that helped me with the artwork, when I told him the title, he grabbed that image from one of my screen grabs, and that's how we got that going.
Well, and it's also the record is such a great tribute also to the Lakeside Lounge, which I visited there in the East Village. Tell me if these dates are okay. You opened in 1996 and you closed in 2012, and it had a kind of a Lake Geneva meets Chicago hideout type feel. Tell us about that club.
Yeah, that was the thing. The Lakeside actually in the logo of the Lakeside Lounge in New York City was the shape of Lake Geneva. And it was kind of patterned after, in a way, you know, Chuck's there in Fontana. You know, a really great bar. It should be fun when it's and inviting when it's empty and when it's packed, you know. And we've sort of, we're striving for sort of a tavern type thing.
And the Lakeside Lounge, I mean, tell us about the history there. You had all, I mean, Joey Ramone came in there, Ryan Adams. Tell us a brief history.
The thing was that my partner, Jim Marshall, who's a DJ, he was a DJ at WFMU for many years. He had this show called The Hound Show, and he was a writer for High Times and other magazines. And we promoted a lot of events at other bars, and then there were bars like the Mercury Lounge, where like I did the consultant thing and helped them design their stage. And finally, we were like, we need to have our own bar. And that, on top of the fact that I had a particularly bad experience at CBGB's after playing there, you know, with every band I ever played with in my whole life, I booked this whole night so I could have some record company guys come to see me. So I had five bands on there, and we're all sharing equipment, and my band is paid guys, and I've got, you know, my manager is taking these guys out to eat. And at the last minute, after a sound check, we go home, and then when we come back, Hilly has put on another band and thrown the whole night off by an hour and a half. So this night, it cost me, you know, over $900, and none of these record company guys got to see my band. So what I wanted to do, and this is another Midwest thing, I wanted to have a bar with a little bandstand that had house equipment that would be the right size equipment for the place, and have only one band play just one set, and have that be the live music component. So the bands could come and have a nice time, and their friends could hang out. And that's actually, when I was on tour with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, we got an invitation to come to Belushi and Aykroyd's Blues Bar in 1980, and they had house equipment in there. And
what, over here, like, over here, yeah. in Old Town, over here in Chicago.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. You went down the alleyway to get there, you know.
Yeah.
And when I saw that thing, I was like, "Wow, that's a great idea." And so I had kind of held that in the back of my mind for the Lakeside. And when I was making the record, I didn't know it was really about the Lakeside. I was just, you know, making a record with Jimbo Mathus. And then all of a sudden I started looking at the songs, and, you know, I never really got to sort of grieve over the loss of the Lakeside. We were pushed out by what I refer to as the real estate monster. When we opened, our rent was $2,200 a month. And when we left, it was $11,000 a month.
Oh, geez.
And in that period, we probably raised the price of beer by a buck and a half.
Gee.
So you can do the math on that. But and I really, my wildest dreams, I couldn't imagine that somebody wouldn't come along and just pick up the slack and do almost exactly what we did, because it was a very successful formula from the very beginning. And really no one has done it. But due to that one band thing, we had all kinds of great people played there. A lot of our friends, you know, what I refer to as my big time buddies would come and play. You know, if they were doing the late night TV shows, those tapings are done by 5 o'clock. They might come down and play. A particularly funny one was my partner was over there, and my friend Brady Blade, he was playing with Jewel, who had just become famous, and she had done the Letterman show. And my partner, who, you know, kind of hates all new music, he was like, "You got to get over here. This is really incredible." We had a lot of great people in there over the years.
Okay, we're going to take a break for some spots, and then we'll come back and we'll play a couple songs off the new record. Is that okay, Eric?
Terrific. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, don't go away on Nocturnal Journal. Thank you. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. That was Crying in My Sleep off the brand new record Lakeside by Eric Amble. That's Eric's composition. You wrote that in 85, Eric, right?
Yeah, that was a song. I had one of those four-track cassette recorders, and I think that I had just gotten some kind of echo machine and also a new guitar, a Stratocaster that had a Wang bar on it. And so that just kind of, a lot of times, and there's other songs on the record that came that way too, where I just kind of start working on some guitar thing. And that's where that one came from. And then it was, the title is kind of alludes to the fact that the song borrows from both, to me, I can hear bits of the song Crying in the Chapel and Sleepwalk.
I was going to say that, yeah, Santo and Johnny, yeah.
Yeah, Crying in My Sleep.
Yeah. So 85, 1980, you moved to New York. I just want to get back to Sense of Place one more time. When you would go back to Lake Geneva, what would the creative process, what was that like when you would come back to the Midwest? Did it clear your mind? Did you see things differently? Did you hear things differently? What was it like to come home? How did that affect your art?
Well, I always came home, and the funny part is that there's a lot of great music in Chicago, but I probably started going to Chicago more as a touring musician than when I lived in Batavia or Lake Geneva, because when I lived in Batavia, I was just trying to get up to the lake as much as possible. And honestly, you know, if you look on the map how far Batavia it is from Chicago, and this is like back when people didn't talk about these kind of things, but it's definitely too far to be driving if you're drinking.
Yeah, right.
So I didn't go to a lot of shows in Chicago until I was a touring musician. But when I would go home in the summer, Milwaukee, that Summerfest is still going. That's a really great festival. You know, I've played on festivals all over the world, and to me, that's one of my favorite ones in the whole world. So every year, if I was home on some kind of break, I would go to Summerfest, you know, maybe even three or four nights, because all my friends that I knew from all over the country, they'd be playing there on tour.
That's the thing. I mean, growing up around here, with your music, and I know your catalog pretty well, there's just a raw, kind of unfiltered Midwest sensibility about it. I mean, was that Chicago radio? Was that stuff you heard around the house? I mean, it's just got that Midwest thing, you know?
I mean, even the, one of the biggest musical experiences in my whole life was when I was sort of kicked out of the University of Wyoming by my parents, and I'm working as a waiter, or working several jobs, you know, back in Illinois, and I heard some music on XRT, and I won tickets to see these two bands that I'd never heard of, I never even heard of them. And it was turned out to be the Ramones and the Dictators. This is a huge life-changing thing for me to go. You know, I went to that gig. They played this place, I believe it was called the Ivanhoe Theater.
Yeah, I remember
must've
that.
Been 77 or 78. And, you know, I had never seen people play their own songs in a place that couldn't hold a sporting event. It was really, the Midwest is a real cover band mentality. I mean, people don't remember how hard it was for musicians. And not only was it hard from this, you know, you had to be in a cover band, also clubs, no club had a PA. So it was almost like you had to have a whole company before you could even go get a gig, you know? Mm-hmm. It was a really daunting thing. I met a lot of really good musicians in the Midwest, and great music came from the Midwest, but it didn't necessarily, especially if you're talking about between 1975 and 1980, it wasn't locally nurtured, you know? Unless you lived in like the hippest neighborhood in the hippest part of town.
Yeah.
You know, if you, you know, there, it wasn't being nurtured in St. Charles or Lake Geneva or Rockford, even the first time I saw Cheap Trick, and they already had their first record out, they were still doing bar gigs, and they would do a set of Beatles, a set of Stones, and a set of originals. I mean, they had to do that to do the gig. And that's part of why I left, you know, because I was trying to find a place where you could play original music.
Okay, tell us about, you mentioned the Dictators and that show. Tell us about the Dell Lords and how that all came together.
Well, I had, after the Joan Jett thing, I was back in New York. I realized that after living in L.A. and living in New York, I just knew L.A. was seemed to be about what you have, and New York was more about what you could do. So I wanted to go home and save up money to go back to New York. And when I got back, I was playing with some guys, and this one guy called me up, and he was like, oh, you know, I played with that guy, Scott, top 10 from the Dictators today. It was awful. They're playing this sort of Chuck Berry, Johnny Cash kind of thing. And I was like, oh, that sounds awful, you know. And as soon as I hung up with the phone from the guy, I figured out how to get a hold of Scott.
Scott Kemp.
And I called.
You're talking about Scott Kemp.
Yeah, top 10 from the Dictators. So I called him up, and then I arranged to come and rehearse with those guys the very next day. And that was the same day that Frank Finero, the Dell Lords drummer, who also has played in Cracker for many years, we both showed up on the same day, and then that was the band for the entire life of the band after that.
And what was the run for the band? What years?
Well, I guess it was sort of 83 to 90. And then we had this guy, you know, most of us stayed in music doing different things. And there was towards the end of the band, maybe 91 was towards the end. We were going to Europe pretty often towards the last 2 or 3 years. And we had done particularly well in Scandinavia and in Spain. And there was this promoter in Spain named Pepe that we would run into, and I'd run into him with Steve Earle, or I'd run into him with the Yehus, or didn't matter what band I was playing with or how big the show, he would go, oh, this is good, but this is not the Dead Lords, you know? And this guy, he just kept offering us tours until finally, you know, when the band finished, it really felt like it was done. But then this guy, he really kind of made us an offer we couldn't refuse. And then we also decided, you know, since I had a recording studio, we didn't want to go over there and just be playing our old stuff. So we wanted to record some new music for the little tour. And that kind of got the band going again. And eventually, you know, we put out this record, Elvis Club, a couple of years ago, did some touring, and we continue to work on the band. We played a little bit towards the end of the year, and we've got another record started.
Okay, now that's why it's the lead-off track on Lakeside, Eric Amble, vinyl only. Eric, give us the website, how people can find this record, and then tell us about the Scott Kempner track, Here Come My Love. We're going to play that. But
okay, yeah, it's ericamble.com, A-M-B-E-L, and that's where you get the record. And, you know, Scott Kempner, he wrote all the songs in the Dell Lords. You know, I sang quite a few of them, but it really felt like he wrote songs for us, for the band. It wasn't like he wrote the songs and he sang them and we backed them up. They were really kind of our songs. And it wasn't just that the arrangements made them ours. He wrote them to be ours. And I've always liked his songs. My first solo record had some of his songs on it. On my third solo record, Knucklehead, I recut the Dell Lords song Judas Kiss with a completely different arrangement. And then this one, Here Come My Love, Scott had done it on one of his solo records, but that same home four-track thing that got me to the song Crying in My Sleep, that also, I had done a demo of Scott's song, Here Come My Love, that was different than the way he recorded it. He had recorded it with the Skeletons. And when I was in the studio with Jimbo Mathis, we were just playing, you know, here's another one. and that was one of them. And we're real happy with it.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and hear Here Come My Love. And then we're going to talk about our friend Lou Whitney and the Skeletons. You dedicated this record to Lou, so we love talking about him. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal 720 WGN with Eric Amble.
Here comes the night, baby's coming soon.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. That was Here Come My Love from the brand new record Lakeside by Eric Amble. And you, in the previous segment there, you were mentioning the Skeletons, the band out of Missouri, the Springfield, Missouri, that we all love. You dedicated this record to Lou. Tell us about how you – did you find Lou and the whole Springfield thing through the Del Lords? Tell us how that all happened.
Yeah, well, the guy – actually, the Dictator's guitar player – Ross the Boss, who had this unbelievably hard-to-swallow band called Manowar, he was like, the Morels were coming through town, and he was like, you got to go see this band. The guitar player is the greatest guitar player in the whole world.
Donnie Thompson.
So and we went to the show, and we met Lou, and it was, you know, I'm living in New York, and it was like to see a New Midwest guys, it was really felt good to me. And Lou was just like, well, we brought him a tape. He goes, well, you got a band? Or, yeah. And he goes, well, if you come down to Springfield, Missouri, I'll record you. And so we bought an old phone company van and drove down there. And he did our first demo, and that demo got us signed to a record deal, you know, it started a long association that went to the time for me.
I mean, you've done your own production. That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about Lou in the studio. And I mean, I know the sense of freedom. What are some things you learned from Lou just as a musician and a producer that you apply to yourself today?
Well, Lou, he kind of demystified the producing process for me. You know, one of his things, he was sort of like, you know, a producer could be just somebody who's done it before, who's kind of like a guide for the band, you know, so they don't go in the studio and waste money or not know what to do, or have an engineer have them focusing on something that isn't quite as important as their songs. And he got me, I learned a lot about it from him. And then, you know, early on in the Del Lords, I started producing. There were some local bands that played around here. There was a pretty cool scene in this after-hours club called No Say No that with these bands, and I started helping those bands in the studio, and that's how I started becoming a producer on my own. You know, and it was mostly because of Lou. I learned a lot from Lou. You know, learning can be from positive and from negative experiences. I also learned from what not to do from some of the Del Lords recordings where we, you know, had all kinds of money and just, to me, seemed to be focusing on the wrong things.
Lou was a bass player. Now, I told you, I was playing this on my turntable. Is it my imagination? There's a there's a great bass sound to this record. Is that just me channeling Lou through Lakeside?
Well, it's, you know, it's like you can't can't build a house without a hammer. You got to have a foundation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I learned so much from Lou, and I'm so lucky to have him in my life. And even all the way to the very end of his life, you know, having gone through the cancer stuff with my dad, I was able to talk to Lou about some tricks to do with the doctors. And then when we started producing this most recent Bottle Rockets record, I actually was in town in St. Louis, and I was able to, like, drive down there in the middle of the night to go see Lou one last time, and that was all because of music.
It's been about a year. What is it, 2 years old, going on 2 years that we lost him?
I guess it would have been in the fall.
People have to find, we're going to wrap it up here, but people have to find the Roscoe's Gang. Is it still available? That was done in Springfield. I want to talk about that a little bit. How did that all come about, and how did you get all those people on there? Has Sid Straw, Peter Holzapfel, you know, the Skeletons?
Well, the Del Lawrence had a manager, and we had a record that we had just finished, a big record, and it was coming out on EMI Records, and the manager brings us into his office and says, the good news is the record company likes the record. The bad news is they can't put it out for another 8 months, so you guys have to go get jobs. So everyone leaves that meeting, and then I call the manager and come in to talk to him myself the next day, and I said, I have all these songs, and I have an idea. I'd like to make my own record. And the manager had this was a really awesome sort of business tip. He goes, you bring me 5 songs and you write up the description of this project and make it so it fits on one piece of paper. And if you can boil it down to that, I'll get you a record deal. And I did that the very next day, and he got me a record deal the day after that. And the whole plan was to go down there and do it with Lou, use the Morels as the band. I say the Morels because, Ron Grimp is a different drummer than Lloyd. Yeah. They're both terrific, but it's sort of like one is the Stones and the other one's the Beach Boys. And
yeah,
I'm always going to side with the Stones in that battle. So, but that's how we ended up down there. And, I had a plan for all the guests, and things worked out. Peter Holzapfel was on tour with REM, and they had they were playing in St. Louis, and then they had a couple of days off, and we went and grabbed him, and Sid Straw, we brought her down there. It was great, and she is one of many people, because I think that I was the first guy to use them as my band, on a record, since the Forbert thing, which was a little different, because the Forbert thing, years before, they had gone out and toured with him. But after I did it, then there was a Jonathan Richmond, Sid Straw, Dave Alvin, Robbie Fulks. They became the band for, and Scott Kempner, for lots of people. And it was just a tremendous experience,
It's just great. I mean, doing Swamp Dog, the one song I wanted to end the segment with. It's a Lou song, but we'll talk about it in a minute. I want to plug the record. People have to find this record too. Lakeside, Eric Amble. One more time, Eric. How can people get it?
EricAmble.com. AMBEL.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can get it. But the guy, my shipping guy, ships really fast, and all my records. All 4 of my solo records are in stock, and I even have a sort of trucker/golf hat too. So you can get what you want from my website.
Are you going to tour behind this? Are you going to come to the Chicago area at all?
I'm going to try to get to Chicago. I'm not sure how much touring I can do because of I own a recording studio and I produce a lot of bands, and that's why I had Jimbo Mathis produce my record. And beyond his music, he's a really visual guy. And I, since I produced his record, White Buffalo, and have been continuing to work with him, he makes really great videos. So I hired him. I have one video that's out now on YouTube, and your listeners can check it out for the song Don't Make Me Break You Down. And I did that with Jimbo down there in Taylor, Mississippi. But I did 3 videos so far for this record, so there is a sort of a visual component to go with the songs, because unless some crazy thing happens. I'm not sure.
A few times. I've never asked you, though, where did the Roscoe come from?
Well, when I lived in California, before playing with Joan, I lived on the corner of Roscoe and Rosita. And the same after-hours club that I was talking about before, where I saw these great local bands in the early 80s, Unlicensed Club, the guy, they had music there. And I asked the guy for a gig, and he just pulled out the book, and he said, well, when do you want to play? It was like the craziest booking thing I'd ever seen. And we booked a date, and he said, what do you want to call it? And I don't even know how I came up with this. And I just said, Roscoe's Gang. And then it sort of, when your name is Eric, there's not a lot of like mutations for, there's not a lot of nickname possibilities.
I never thought of it that way.
The thing kind of stuck.
You're kind of right. Okay, so we're going to sign off. I want you to set up this Lou Whitney composition. It's from Eric Amble, Roscoe's Gang. Great song, 30 Days in the Workhouse. Give me a little of the backstory of recording this. And Eric, thanks so much for being so generous for your time. You're just a great interview. You're very detailed.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I'm so glad. When we were making the Roscoe's Gang record, a lot of it was planned, but some of it was kind of up in the air. And I had heard that, you know, Lou was all kind of in a position like I'm in now, where he was so busy working in the studio on other stuff, they weren't really recording that much. And I don't think they had recorded their song 30 Days in the Workhouse. And I wanted to have, you know, when Roscoe's Gang, when we did our first gigs, there were gigs that were electric gigs, but we also played sort of a folk vibe at the famous Gertie's Folk City.
Oh, yeah.
In the Village. So there was an acoustic component that I wanted to get on the record. And this song, it's just an unbelievable song. The sentiment is just timeless. I mean, you can't believe it's sort of sad that it's as relevant. It stays relevant in a way, you know what I mean? And I just asked him if we could do it. And then we, you know, it has a whole bunch of short verses, so we were able to trade verses with myself and Peter Holsapple and Sid Straw, and Lou sings the Down by the Nola Chucky verse, and it's still, whenever I play it, it goes over big, and it was just great to have Lou's song on there.
So let's hear it. Thanks again, Eric Amble. We hope to see you real soon. Here's 30 Days.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, thank you very much. 30 Days in the Workhouse.
I took an apple from a storehouse. They arrested me. I wonder why the good Lord let them grow on trees. I got 30 days in the workhouse. Don't you shed no tears. Sip on me.